Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the New Tide of Optimism show because as we're recording this show, this is after the President's State of the Union address when he notes the new tide of optimism sweeping our land. We are not making comments on that, simply noting that that was the start of the President's State of the Union address back in January. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and let me introduce our cast. First of all, still recovering from frostbite from her traffic reporting in Isomville, the assistant professor at the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And Rick has gone on a tirade. We put Rick in the, what would you call it, Rick? The non-functional.
At the kiddie table?
Yeah, the non-functional chair. Hopefully he can look up to the microphone and tell you how to find us on the web. The UK Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony, you should be glad Shelley's between us.
I'm not glad that I'm between
there. There is a certain tension in the studio, not unlike the tension that pervaded the room during the State of the Union address, I might point out.
Yeah, the weird thing is, Tony, I don't think we're separated by political differences. I think it's – I really just don't like you tonight.
It's height. It's more than anything else, it's height. I am at eye level.
All that being said, WMKY.org is where you'll find the audio of Health Matters. That's Moorhead State Public Radio's website. Look through the menus. You'll find all the shows. In there is Health Matters. You'll find a list of our most recent shows with a little summary and a link to the audio. Download it. Listen to it. Put it on your device. Listen to it over and over again. Send a friend a link. You know, we're getting close to Valentine's Day, so obviously this would be a great Valentine's gift. This would just show how much you love that significant other in your life, right, to give them Health Matters.
And it's cheap, too.
It's a lot more than cheap. Audio of the show, WMKY.org. There, it's time for you to get angry with Health Matters and jump over on Facebook.com/HM Radio Show. You can do a search for Health Matters, but it's best to just go ahead and do the /HM Radio Show on the end, because you'll get the Health Matters. There's a bunch of them on there, but we want you to find ours. There you can leave us some feedback, suggest some topics. Maybe there's a question you have. Maybe there's a particular piece of news that's out there that you think is fake and you need it evaluated. Well, Tony is the ultimate in fake news sniffer-outer, right? He can sniff it out.
Or maybe it'll be the article for next week's show.
Well, here, the fun is not knowing. And so go to Facebook.com/HM Radio Show and you will find out.
Our sponsor for today's show, Sugar Sweetened Beverage Taxes. A spoonful of taxation helps the sugar go down. I'm going to take you in way back in time to June 2017. Tufts University reported on the spread of local taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages, and they felt that it is likely to continue in the future. Now, I apologize in pulling this show together. I don't know how many municipalities have added on since June, but back in June, there were 7 U.S. municipal or county jurisdictions have adopted excise taxes to reduce the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverage. An 8th one added in the month of June. Seattle was the 8th local jurisdiction to tax sugar-sweetened beverages. So Tufts and Harvard Kennedy School evaluated the reasons for success or failure. They looked at both the successful municipality sugar-sweetened beverage taxes, but also the ones that had failed. And they published this in Food Policy back on June 6th. And here's what they found. The single most important characteristic of a city that would pass a beverage tax is Democratic Party dominance.
You think?
Yeah, because this is a government function. If you've signed a no new taxes pledge and you're for smaller government, you're probably not going to be too enthusiastic about it. They point out 40% of the U.S. population lives in Democratic-run cities, and so there is certainly a wide potential for additional sugar-sweetened beverage taxes in the U.S. In addition, whichever pathway municipality took, there were three general conditions. Again, the Democratic Party dominance, number one. Secondly, external financial support for pro-tax advocates. When you start proposing a tax, the beverage industry, particularly in these larger cities, will pour money into creating a campaign to try to defeat the tax. They feel that that's going to reduce consumption, which is what you hope will happen, and they don't like that. So you've got to have some dollars to match their dollars, or the discussion becomes very much one way and not about the things that you want to talk about. And then finally, a political message appropriate to the process. And that was pretty pretty interesting. If it's a voter ballot, they said this is a public health concern, and that was mostly successful. You say, look, we need to help people to make better choices. If we take this money and we use it for something that helps them make better choices, then this would be a good thing. This will help save people's lives and could save a lot of lives by preventing diabetes and keeping people from gaining weight. If it is a inside the city council and there is an ordinance for the city council, it is a economic measure. That is, we can generate some money from this tax, which will help spending on municipal projects. So the appropriate message, whether it's for the voters, for public health, for the politicians, that gives them some more money to enact their programs, external support, and most of all, number one, a strongly democratic city, municipality, run municipality. Those are the things that will get you a sugar-sweetened beverage tax.
So which of those three do you think is most important?
Absolutely democratic. It will not happen regardless of funding, regardless of message. Their impression is it's very unlikely to happen in a Republican-dominated municipal setting. So
so that's most of rural America.
Well, right now. Again, midterm elections coming up may have some impact on that. And so far, it seems the U.S. voters will adopt one party and will switch parties pretty vigorously if they're not satisfied with the way government's working. So my impression is there may be a few more later on. Right now, the state of Kentucky, Republican at the state level. So we will not get a state tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. I am frankly surprised still as we go to press with this show, there is still a glimmer of a possibility we may get an increase in the cigarette tax, which would be a wonderful thing to help save lives in the state of Kentucky. But again, it's still going to face an uphill battle. So that is our sponsor, Sugar Sweetened Beverage Tax. A spoonful of taxation helps the sugar go down. Now, I will read to you the from the President's State of the Union speech. A new tide of optimism was already sweeping across our land. Each day since, we have gone forward with a clear vision and a righteous mission to make America great again for all Americans. And so you think to yourself, well, you know, what would that tide of optimism look like? And so our first article, this is from National Public Radio.
Is it wearing a red hat?
No, it's about teenagers eating Tide Pods.
Can we use some kind of an adjective to describe said kid?
You were searching for it, I think, last week, but go ahead, take a shot.
No, I'm not going to say it because I'll get in trouble.
In the month of January, as of January 30th, Poison Control Centers had received 134 reports of intentional exposures to laundry packets, of kids basically filling their mouth with laundry packets and biting into them and then calling the Poison Control Center. In addition, on an annual basis, Poison Control Centers get more than 10,000 reports of smaller children who don't know better accidentally getting their hands on laundry packets. So these packets, they do some damage. 134 reports in January, 53 reports for all of 2017, and the 134, again, is older teenagers who are doing it intentionally. So those are the numbers behind this. As Rick says, it's absolutely bizarre. It's the sort of thing, I guess, if you're a risk taker, putting your mouth full of laundry detergent.
Here's the thing.
Rick, when you were young,
risk. You know it's poison. It's not like, you know, mud or some of the crazy stuff we did 50 years ago. Did you lick on a poison lollipop when you were a kid?
I'm thinking.
You might have ate a bug. You know, I mean, when you dared your buddy to do something, it might be eat this grasshopper.
Yeah. Well, I did that when I rode a bicycle. I don't remember really.
Just saying, we, you know.
Certainly not intentionally ingesting something poisonous, even on a dare. My friends were more kind of, I guess, conservative, non-daring type of friends.
Well, I mean, I get it, but, I mean, I don't know. This whole Tide Pod thing just seems absurd to me that somebody has gone wrong in teaching values to these children or kids or young adults or, you know, who knows. But it's just amazing that somebody would take a known poison.
Yeah. This,
I mean, they wouldn't do it with rat poison, right?
No, and rat poison actually...
I don't know.
I better not say anything about rat
poison. I don't
know.
Well, I'm just saying, I think, I mean, I don't understand how they can look at this and go, oh, you know, that orange and blue liquid in that looks like that would taste like ice cream.
No, I don't think there's any mistaking. They know it's detergent. They know it's going to be ugly. It's a challenge. It's a dare. So I guess, you know, is this the dark side of the ice water challenge for ALS? In other words, you do something that makes you very uncomfortable just to prove that you're somehow courageous or something like that. So what you do is you say, okay, look, anybody can throw ice water over their head. By golly, I'm going to fill my mouth with laundry detergent.
And when can we start trying to prove we're smart?
It's a legitimate question.
Maybe intelligent. I don't know.
Wow. Let's do something smart for diabetes. How about that? You know, think of something smart to do and challenge your friends to do something smart for diabetes rather than throwing buckets of water over your head or eating laundry detergent pods.
Well, I mean, the ice bucket thing was a combination of embarrassment and, you know, because everybody reacts differently to the ice cold water, right?
Right.
I mean, so it was really, to me, you had to do it on video. It was more of a... It was more of an embarrassing thing there, and it was, again, an attempt to raise money. This is just, you know, I skirted around it last week because, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, Darwin's theory here. I mean, you know, this is the thinning of the herd, but you know, you don't want to get that morbid. But in the same token, this is absolutely idiotic. I mean, I did really dumb things when I was a kid. I did dumber things when I was a teenager, and I did...
Just wondering when the past tense is going to end. But yeah. Let's face it.
I'm
going to
stop.
Matters, right. But let's just say collectively at Health Matters, we have a real sympathy and love for stupid people because we are one.
Exactly. And we've perfected it.
But it never occurred to me to eat laundry detergent.
No, I could be accidentally much stupider than that. You would just go, "Uh-oh, this doesn't look good." You don't have to plan to be stupid. Stupid just happens. It breaks out spontaneously at our house.
And how long before there's a warning on the Tide Pod that says, "Please don't eat the orange."
It's there, I think.
Oh my gosh.
It's there.
I don't do that much with Tide in my house, so I'm sorry to say I haven't looked at one up close.
I think it's there. They've changed the way the packages open and close to make it harder for like toddlers, people who don't know any better, you know, to get into it. But
there's no dealing with teenagers. Well, a rising tide of optimism is sweeping across our land, but we're going to have to take a break and try to deal with this rising tide. Why don't you do so as well and join us for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I don't know who I am.
I'm Shelley Irving.
This low chair is kind of working.
I actually said my name, but you couldn't hear it from where I was.
Because he's down. Rick is not used to being the shortest guy in the room, and I think it's just really, he's lost his confidence.
You wouldn't happen to have a Tide Pod.
Yeah, therapy here. We'll try to get him back. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the new Tide of Optimism show. We are mentioning our president's State of the Union address, which I listened to, and I'm very serious about this. I listened to with rapt attention. To see how that would go. Our sponsor for the second time is Sugar Sweetened Beverage Tax. A spoonful of taxation helps the sugar go down. Now, we talked about last June. It looks like then these sugar sweetened beverage taxes could spread. If you have a democratically controlled municipality, you're able to get some funding to counter the opposition's message, and you emphasize both the financial part and the public health part, you may be able to get these things passed. We belief that it's a good thing. We think that this is something that could have a big effect on public health. So the reason I brought back that June article is January 26th in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health, researchers looked at these are British researchers. They looked at a study on what happens if you increase the price of sugar-sweetened beverage. How does that affect alcoholic beverage purchases?
Interesting.
Oh, maybe there's a ripple effect. Maybe we haven't thought this through, or maybe we have. The methodology is a little tough. They had almost 32,000 households. 80% they had in two separate years, two separate studies, 5 years apart. And that was 6 million beverage purchases at these over that period of time at these 32,000 households. Now, they grouped them by brand and package level. And they had 11 distinct beverage groups for the studies. One, high sugar drinks, more than 8 grams of sugar per 100 milliliters. And you might say, well, what is a high sugar drink? And I've got it.
High sugar.
That is harassment. I will.
No, I was pointing honestly, to my Mountain Dew.
No, but
is it a Tide Pod?
No. Mountain Dew, as a matter of fact. Is a high sugar drink, 13 grams of sugar per 100 milliliters. Rockstar Punched Guava is 15 grams. Coke Cherry, 11.2. Pepsi is 11. Red Bull is 11. Monster Energy Drink, 11. 7-Up is 11. Coca-Cola, 10.6. Cherry 7-Up, 10.0. And those are, in the United Kingdom, common fizzy drinks, they call them, soft drinks contain more than 10 grams of sugar per 100 milliliters. So that's their top category. Medium sugar drinks, 5 to 8 grams of sugar per 100 milliliters, and I've got those as well. The only ones they mention, Dr. Pepper, Sprite, Schweppes Indian Tonic Water, and surprisingly, for me anyway, Fanta Orange. I would have thought Fanta Orange had a lot of sugar in it. It has less than Mountain Dew, Coke, and Pepsi. And then the diet or low sugar drinks, less than 5 grams of sugar. These are reduced calorie.
Wouldn't you like to know how the overall sales track based on sugar content? So are the sugary drinks, are they the more popular selling drinks?
Yeah, but you know, they're the ones that are advertised. Again, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Mountain Dew, you know, there's...
Yeah, but some of those aren't... I mean, Red Bull is not on every TV ad and all over print media. But if it's high in the sales...
Yeah,
I'd be curious to see how the sales track the sugar.
Yeah. Like I said, it would be a little tough, but I see what you're saying. And it may be, well, I don't know. I'm figuring that the high sugar drinks are the ones, because they have more advertising, I think they're the ones that the companies think will sell the best. I mean, let's face it, you know, if you had a Fanta Orange, you could put all the advertising you want to in it, and it's still Fanta Orange.
What's wrong with Fanta Orange?
Not my favorite drink.
I get it.
Yeah.
And but so, it's great. It's good stuff.
You think Fanta Orange is good?
Well, we have Diet Fanta occasionally. My daughter loves Fanta. But
I don't.
The thing with Fanta is that was a big drink when we'd go on vacation to Mexico.
Yeah, true. But yeah. I don't know. You know, I always heard the Mexican had the Mexican versions had more sugar in them. I don't know.
I don't remember.
Okay.
Seems to me like they were pretty sweet.
They were pretty sweet. So you got your high sugar drinks, medium sugar, low sugar drinks, fruit juices, milk-based drinks, excluding milk. I guess that's Yoo-hoo. I don't know.
That's chocolate milk.
Yeah. I don't know. Water, beer, lager, cider, wines, and spirits. Now, they use this high, medium, and low. That is the plan in the United Kingdom for a sugary beverage tax, which will be enacted in April. So this is not a random categorization. This is the categorization of a contemplated tax in the United Kingdom. So first thing I learned from this, they're planning on taxing beverages in the UK. They're already doing it in Mexico. So Rick would not have nearly as much fun with his Fanta vacation that he took in Mexico now because it costs more. Just pointing that out. What they found, though, so they divided these up, they monitored, and I think what they did was an association. That is, if you drank this much sweet beverages, high sugar beverages, what else would you buy if you drank this much? So if we force somebody from one category to the other, what would happen to the other beverages that they buy? And here's what they found. If you increase the price of high sugar drinks, you increase the purchase of lager.
So if I can't have the sweet drink I want, I drink beer.
You want to drink beer. If you increase the price of medium sugar drinks, that's your Dr. Pepper, your Fanta, and Sprite, if you increase the price of them, it decreases purchases of all alcoholic drinks. Yeah, I guess if you can't have those medium sugar, those people move to, I suppose, healthy drinks. I don't know. If you increase the price.
Or high sugar.
Yeah, maybe so. No, they didn't say that. And they're going to, I believe what they're going to do is have a graded tax, so they're trying to, across the board, decrease the purchase of sugary drinks. And then if you increase the price of diet or low sugar drinks, that increases purchases of beer, cider, and wines. So again, you have to think about it. If one becomes more expensive, your target audience may simply switch, not necessarily go to water or to I don't know what else is healthy besides water. I guess water, really. Green tea or herbal.
Ooh.
Coffee. I don't know.
He says that because he's the green tea drinker.
Yeah, yeah.
I drink a commercial brand of green tea, which I have found out is worthless from a health standpoint. I did all this. I switched from soft drinks to green tea, and I don't think I've helped myself at all.
So he's a do what I say, not as I do kind of guy.
Right.
Well, I made a switch. It just turned out it was the wrong switch. I thought I was switching to something healthy.
Did you switch back?
I drink.
What's that you got over there?
Yeah, I drink more. I've got green tea here, but I do drink more diet pop.
Has it got an add-on? Does it have something else in it? It's a green tea with, what is that, red berry?
Yeah, it's berry.
That sounds like sugar to me.
Yeah, how much sugar is in that?
Zero calories. All right, since you're going to ask me, here we go. Calories, zero. Carbohydrates, zero. Sugars, zero. I mean, it's practically pond water.
It looks like pond water.
It does look like pond water. I give you that.
It tastes like it. Yeah. So but the thing is, I'm used to it now. I sort of like it. You know, do this.
I promise you, if I just sort of liked something, I'd find something I really like.
You go back to your diet Mountain Dew.
That'd be the thing. If I was in the middle section, I just sort of liked it, I'd go to the other section.
Well, they pointed out then that there could be both public health benefits and unanticipated public health consequences of a tax on sugar-sweetened beverage. Now, the big thing is, if you do this, and Mexico City has already proved this, if you do it, you can get a 10 to 20% drop in beverage consumption. And these sugar-sweetened beverages, it's sugar without feeling full. This is just a really particularly stressful way to get your hydration. It does appear to be associated with a substantial weight gain and also higher risk of diabetes. So there is this political experimentation going on. What if we did alter these taxes? What would happen? And I think this level of analysis says it's going to be a little more complicated than simply people stop drinking the unhealthy stuff. Wanted people to know that. That's all I'm saying.
That's probably not all you're saying.
Next up, from the Journal of Health Economics, January 29th. You'll like this, Rick. This is something that I have been thinking a lot about since I read this.
And since I know exactly what you've been thinking.
The connection between retiring early and living longer.
Which one are you going to do?
Well, both, probably. Economists from the Netherlands looked at what happened when, in 2005, some Dutch civil servants could temporarily qualify for early retirement. Now, here's the thing. They've got Dutch civil servants. They have a different health care system. They have generally different public health problems in the Netherlands than they have here.
Different meal plans.
Yeah.
Different,
so there's a lot of things that this may not translate. Only those 55 years old with at least 10 years of service were eligible. Those who responded to early retirement, so they had this opportunity. Here was an early retirement offer. Some people kept going, some didn't. The people who responded to early retirement were 2.6% less likely to die over the next 5 years. Now, 2.6% less likely to die in the next 5 years, that's
worth retiring for.
It is. And the other thing is, I'm not telling you have to get up at 6 a.m. and go to the gym, or that you have to buy some product or start taking pills. All you got to do is retire.
But maybe this says more about those that chose the early retirement than it does about the early retirement itself.
Well, the one thing I will say is, at least in this country, there's probably not a tie into it socioeconomically, right? I mean, I think they have a system of retirement that it's not like – like in America, if you're going to retire early, you had to have planned ahead. You've had to have, you know, built up a 401k or some kind of pension plan yourself. I mean, most employers wouldn't let you retire that early. Hey, save the military or, you know, somebody that's got like a 30 or 35-year plan. But so it is interesting.
The Dutch safety net, in my opinion, is stronger than the U.S. safety net. So even if you didn't necessarily have it all planned out, I think you could get more help there, but I don't know. But look at this. Analysis from the United States found about 7 years of retirement can be as good for your health as dropping your chance of getting a serious disease by 20%. In other words, you can retire, and even if you do get a serious disease, you're better off than if you continued working. Positive effects of retirement have also been found by studies using data from Israel, England, Germany, and other European countries. Again, they all have different healthcare systems than we do, and in many cases support retirees better. But there still is, across many different countries, a link between retirement and positive health benefits. The thing about it is, you're absolutely right. A person is more likely, if you think about it, a person is, on the one hand, is more likely to retire early if they're in strong financial status, but they're also, if they are sick, they are more likely to retire early.
But is that retirement?
Well,
I mean, is that disability?
Well, what it means is, I can no longer do this job. Why don't I go ahead and take this retirement package, because I'm really struggling to get my job done in the first place? So I can argue that both the best and the worst risk, the lowest and the highest risk people, would retire early. Just making that argument.
Dutch, do you buy it? You buy it, Shelley?
No, I mean, I think it could go the other way as well.
You're egging her on.
He's instigating.
From your low spot on the floor there, you were yelling up at Shelley to try to get a fight started, because you're not tall enough to take me on yourself.
And it didn't take much, did it? It was pretty simple.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take the other argument. Maybe these people are healthier, and maybe they're more active, and they have ideas for how they could sustain themselves financially if they take an early retirement.
Yeah, I mean, they figured out they want to be a scratch golfer. They want to see the world.
They want to travel.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're able to travel.
I totally agree with you, and not him.
Yeah, see, we're right. We're always right.
All right, guests. I'm going to retire, and you guys will be so happy that you're still working. And we'll just see who lives the longest. I'm willing to run this experiment. Again, work can be stressful, takes time away from exercise, promotes bad habits. Half of the mortality reduction associated with retirement is attributable to cardiovascular and digestive system diseases. Obesity, smoking, alcohol consumption, as well as reduced exercise and stress all contribute to those. Now, we are not, any of us, smoking because we're still working. I don't think any of us are drinking heavily because of stress at work. So maybe this doesn't apply to us as it does to the Dutch, but I'm not sure. Some studies find retirement associated with worse health, as you said. One found retirement raises your risk of cardiovascular disease. Another found higher risk of cardiovascular disease and cancer. But a third study showed that poor health outcomes were more pronounced among retirees who were unmarried when they reduced their physical activity and had less social interaction. So in other words, if I retire to go and hermite, to be a hermit in the woods, hermite being the verb for become a hermit.
Or be a binge Netflixer.
Yeah, something like that, then yes, it's going to be associated with worse health. If, on the other hand, I have a spouse, which I happen to have.
You and your wife go to church regularly.
Yeah, and we do social things together, and we can avoid this constant bickering we've had. But that's not for radio, of course. This is just a private
thing. I totally agree
with
you, Tony. Yeah.
But if we can work together, then perhaps retirement actually has benefits for health. Rick's got this really just satisfied smile. Like, okay. So that's all I'd say about retirement. It's a mystery, and it. Obviously, for each of our individual Health Matters listeners, they're going to have to figure that out. However, I think the idea that retirement leads to decay, if retirement is properly managed and properly done, there is at least, this research indicates, a chance of an improvement in your health with retirement.
It is interesting that no matter how we come about it, no matter whether it's technology, whether it's retirement, whether it's, you know, we always end up with, you really have to eat right, you really have to exercise, and you have to figure out what that combination is for you, and you have to do it your entire life. It doesn't matter whether you're working, retired, kid, young. I mean, you've got to figure out how to balance a combination of exercise and consumption of you know, food and lack of sugary beverages, and then everything's going to work out.
So retirement,
or it has a better chance of working
is
out.
A part of a generally healthy laundry detergent free lifestyle.
Well, direct. It's okay if it touches your clothes. You just don't want to.
It could be actually
ingest
beneficial.
Ingest it.
All right. let's completely switch gears, but stay with health. Los Angeles Times.
Well, it's good because we're a health show.
January 30th, because I couldn't get the original report. This is not a common journal, apparently. But this was McGill University did a study, and I got it out of the summary of the Los Angeles Times.
Is that a real university?
Yeah, McGill's in Canada. And the research team looked at the four most popular plant-based milks on the market: almond, soy, rice, and coconut. And they said, what is the healthiest, most nutritious of those four milks? First of all, none of them added up to the nutritional value of real milk. When you look at the protein, when you look at the nutritional value of, we say real milk, of cow's milk, essentially, they are all lacking in some nutritional items, nutritional components of cow's milk. So they're not as good if you are looking at nutrition. Now, obviously, we promote water, so maybe the idea of nutritional value is not what you're looking for. But if you have an elderly person, a person who's maybe losing weight or frail, and you're trying to build them up, it's pretty clear that cow's milk, if they are able to tolerate it, is going to be a healthier alternative than almond, soy, rice, or coconut. Of the four, though, soy milk, clearly the best. It has a balanced nutritional profile, protein, phytonutrients. Those are the things that may be able to lower your risk of cancer. And it has not been shown to be harmful to people's health. There was some concern that soy milk might affect the endocrine system, throw off your hormones, but no, it looks like soy milk's pretty good. Rice milk, the worst. It is basically carbs and sugar, and that's it. Nothing good in rice milk. Coconut milk, low calorie, low protein, and possibly lowers your bad cholesterol counts, but do not drink coconut milk to lower your cholesterol. That's stupid. You know, it's not going to work. You're not going to see that much of a change. So almond milk, larger amounts of healthy fats that can lower cholesterol. They have some protein, but not anywhere near as much as real milk. So there are your dairy-free milks, soy at the top, almond second, rice the worst, coconut better than rice. You ever drank these milks, Rick?
I've had almond milk before.
What'd you think about the taste?
I felt like that was the only reason to drink it.
Okay.
Right? The almond milk just tasted a little different, and it had, you know, obviously an almond taste to it. If you're not a milk drinker, that's one way to try to enjoy, you know, milk. Me, I don't mind milk. You put enough chocolate syrup in it, it's great.
Soy milk.
You've had soy milk, and it's the one. We're going to take a milk break and come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
He's Rick Phillips.
Did you like how I got that this time?
I love how you got that.
I moved my chair up.
He's
I quit
sitting,
listening to jazz.
He's sitting on his tippy toes.
Hey, now, you and I were aligned this last segment. You best watch out.
Oh, the fragmentation continues. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the new tide of optimism. Again, we are quoting from the president's State of the Union address when he said, a new tide of optimism is sweeping across our land. Our sponsor for the final time, sugar-sweetened beverage taxes. A spoonful of taxation helps the sugar go down. And we talked about in the first fractional portion, second fractional portion, the fact that these sugar-sweetened beverage taxes are becoming more common both in the United States. We are up to, I believe, 8 or more local jurisdictions have sugar-sweetened beverage taxes in the United States. Berkeley, San Francisco, El Monte, Richmond, Oakland, and Albany in California, Boulder, Colorado, Philadelphia. And Philadelphia, it's an odd one. I think it's at the airport. That's one on more on travelers. Cook County, Illinois, Santa Fe, New Mexico, all of those 68 to 84% registered Democrats and Democratic mayors. And also Seattle, Washington has added a sugar-sweetened beverage tax as well. Mexico City has one and has already reported out the 1 and 2 year results, which were a 10 to 20% reduction in the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverage. However, they did not look at the alternative beverages, and that was our last fractional portion. We pointed out that apparently if you lower the high sugar drinks, then they go. Your patrons may adopt a beverage strategy involving more lager. If you do the lower the medium sugar drinks, and that's pretty much Dr. Pepper and Sprite and Fanta Orange, then they actually drink less alcohol. So there may be either benefits or at least changes associated with these taxes that we had not anticipated. But the main thing we are trying to do with these taxes is drop the consumption of sugar. Or, if you want to be specific, high fructose corn syrup, which is in these drinks, a very, very concentrated form of sugar. And also, by being in a beverage, it does not produce the feeling of fullness. You simply drink all that sugar, and then you're going to go ahead and eat about the same thing as you would have eaten anyway. Your sense of fullness is much, I won't say completely, but apparently a large amount of it is based on how much bulk you have in your stomach, not necessarily what chemicals you put in your stomach. A lot of things to think about there. That's our sponsor. I don't have anything new to say for a third fractional portion. Just simply, I believe that this might work. I do not believe it will happen in Kentucky. Even though we have municipalities with Democratic control right now, the state is very solidly Republican. That's our sponsor, Sugar Sweetened Beverage Tax. A spoonful of taxation helps the sugar go down. This is from San Diego. It is from... And I'm sorry, Zhiwei, who's South University in Changsha, China. And I absolutely butchered that because I don't speak Chinese and I don't know how to say these people's names. They pointed out that the Cochrane Library, this is a library that records these systematic reviews, and they look at things. They said, you know, if you do injections, corticosteroids, steroid injections in a person's knee, you may get some improvement in pain, but you can't tell whether it improves function or whether it alters the course of arthritis. Now, there are several types of arthritis. There is rheumatoid arthritis, which is an inflammatory condition where inflammatory proteins attack your joints. It happens at a younger age. It is more common among women than men. And this inflammatory condition, you've got to take some pretty serious medicines to control the inflammation, or it will produce serious joint damage. There are other inflammatory arthritis. Phil Mickelson has psoriatic arthritis. He has psoriasis, a skin disease, and also an arthritis coming from that. But the far and away, the most common arthritis has nothing to do with inflammatory proteins. It's simply a wear and tear arthritis that causes thinning of the cartilage and eventually causes damage to the bone, and it's called osteoarthritis. It's more common in the knees and the weight-bearing joints. It is more common among people who are overweight. It also can affect people who run a lot and put a lot of stress on their joints, pounding the joints. So they were looking specifically at this osteoarthritis, not at inflammatory arthritis. They reported in San Diego at an annual meeting of the American College of Rheumatology, they reported a group of 140 patients, 45 years and older, who had evidence of osteoarthritis, and they said, all right, half of them are going to get injections of steroids, and half of them aren't. They inject the steroids every 12 weeks on a regular scheduled basis for 2 years, and then they asked them, how are you doing? There was no difference in the reported pain between the intervention and control groups. Those who got the injections actually lost more cartilage, and that was reported in the AMA journal last year. Then they looked at what they called a real-life cohort. They examined a study, an osteoarthritis initiative study. That's almost 5,000 patients, ages 45 to 79, who went to one of four U.S. clinics with arthritis of their knee or high risk. And they followed them for 4 years, and they found that the ones who got injections were almost six times more likely to have changes in their knee joints. They were also about, looks like 1.6 times, about 60% more likely to get knee replacement surgery. Now, the one where they randomized them, that's your best study. This one where they observed them, it may be that people who are on their way to knee replacement surgery anyway get more injections as their knees deteriorate. But there is no evidence that getting a steroid injection in your knees makes your knees stronger or healthier. In fact, there is some evidence that it causes them to deteriorate faster. If it makes you feel better to get a steroid injection for osteoarthritis, for the wear and tear arthritis, then we at Health Matters understand that. You want to try to walk and to be able to move around as much as you can on your way to probably what's going to be knee replacement surgery. But you don't want to get those injections to make your knee stronger or to prevent damage, because, in fact, they don't do that for osteoarthritis. Rheumatoid arthritis, other types of arthritis, that's a different matter. Other joints other than the knee, we don't know. But for the knee, the weight-bearing joint in osteoarthritis, it looks like those injections do not prevent you from having deterioration that may wind up leading to a knee replacement. I know a lot of people get injections.
Yeah, I do too. But I don't – after hearing the results of that study, it makes sense just from what we see clinically. They continue to have problems. They continue to deteriorate.
I was going to say, the shot's usually just 2 years in front of the surgery, right?
Yeah. And Shelly and I had this interesting – this is why I put this in. Well, one of the many reasons I put this in, we were at a clinic working together, and a person came in, and this person knew that she was getting arthritis, so she wanted to get something done early. She wanted to get on top of things and try to prevent having deterioration to the point where – she might need to have her knee replaced. So we talked to her about losing weight. We told her she was not going to be able to walk long distances, like take a 5-mile walk every day for her health. And she asked about, well, should I get an MRI scan? Should I get further x-rays? Should I be seeing a specialist and getting things injected? And we told her no. Now, I didn't have this paper in hand, but my general feeling was that you can't get on top of this arthritis. In fact, what happens with a knee replacement is your knee gets so bad that you can't walk anymore. You limp into the doctor's office and say, we've got to do something, and that's when you get your knee replacement. An early knee replacement just means you'll probably have to replace the knee hardware. That's all that means. By the way, that's just a really crummy way to take care of a knee problem. I wish we had better information. Keep your weight down. Try to keep the muscles strong. But don't try to walk your way out of knee arthritis. Almost every time, you're going to make that worse. Better to exercise without putting weight down. That's swimming, bicycling, things like that are much better if you get arthritis of the knee.
You know, I tell you, the knee surgery is not, unless somebody has an actual injury, the majority of the time you see that associated with, you know, folks that are nearing retirement age. I don't know that I've encountered one person who has said they wish they didn't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it apparently the technology's gotten so good and the procedures have gotten so good that it is life-changing.
It is. I'll give you another take on it, though, is once again, the surgeons are smart enough to wait until
it's time.
It's time. That is, you know, if you say, well, let's go ahead and get that knee replaced now before it starts to cause you trouble, then you're going to see a lot of dissatisfied customers. But if a person comes in and says, I can't walk, and you say, I can fix it so you can walk, then that's a big, big deal. You're absolutely right. It's interesting. The fall risk goes up because finally they can walk, and you have to be able to walk to fall.
Right.
But they do get around well, and I will echo what Rick says. Knee replacement surgery is remarkable in getting people back up and moving around who were unable to do so before. And most of the customers, you know, there's a rare infection, blood clots, or other problems with it. It's not 100% safe, but boy, when it works, it is spectacular in some people.
And how many times have you seen a person get just one knee done? I mean, in most cases, they get one done, they recover, and they get the other one done. I mean, within whatever the minimum time is.
Right. Yeah, you should plan on, I mean, once you fix your worst knee, then your second worst knee becomes your worst knee. And you've been walking on both knees pretty much the same throughout your life. So that does make you're absolutely right.
And typically, if all goes well, the rehab for that isn't too bad either.
Right.
People tend to tolerate that very well.
Tony, I don't understand why you didn't bring research that talks about early retirement and knee replacement.
You think people retire because they get their knees replaced? Do you think people get their knees replaced?
If you retire early, will you not need knee replacement?
I assume if you're walking a lot on the job, you may be able to save your knees a little bit.
I don't understand why you didn't fully cover this topic.
Busy, okay? I've had a little virus,
I've progressed up the ladder. you're going to have to be a little more descriptive on that busy. And I'm using air quotes.
Rick
busy.
Has managed that during the breaks, Rick has managed to do some emergency repairs to his chair, and his mood has improved throughout the show. Let me talk about the one or two things others I've got. I want to do this. This was
like
the title was right. You don't. So just I'm going to come over and hit the down button on your chair, and then we'll just
hey, I'm
we'll
just glad you didn't resort goes. To the jazz, Tony.
Do that. Hey, let's go jazz, Rick. I never thought that would be an insult. I like jazz.
The thing is, you're a drummer, bad. And I bet you can play jazz.
I feel bad about liking jazz now. It's like I'm not even a man if I like jazz.
Well, we shouldn't make fun of jazz because jazz, I mean, they're like I said, Rick, jazz drummers are really good.
They got testosterone levels. I mean, this is not like it's someone's opinion. This is testosterone levels and music choices.
And plus, it's just crazy research we bring on the show. Who knows?
I do. I really do. 24th January, 2018. This was in BMJ. It's the initial. It's like KFC. BMJ stands for British Medical Journal, except they don't call it the British Medical Journal anymore. They call it the BMJ. So, okay. I don't know. There's not even any frying involved in
it's
this.
It's not a BLT.
So, yeah. I don't know why they did that. But the title's provocative. It says 60 Seconds on Loneliness. In January, they reported that the United Kingdom, Great Britain, has appointed Tracy Crouch as their first Minister for Loneliness. I am not making this up. They have a Minister for Loneliness.
I would nominate you.
I assume he has his own office. I'm sorry.
You had to go there, didn't
yeah,
you?
Just
you think that now. But
whoever wrote this research did it alone, right?
Yeah, with no staff help. Yeah, no.
There's a single author of this particular piece, but stay focused. Stay focused. This is important. There's a wealth of statistics on loneliness. 58% of migrants and refugees in London describe loneliness and isolation. 43% of the 17 to 25 year olds who use Action for Children services, that's basically a government service, experience loneliness. 8 out of 10 caregivers experience loneliness, so it is common. The second thing, one analysis of 148 studies found that social isolation, loneliness, or living alone had a significant effect on the risk of premature death, one that was equal to other risk factors like obesity and smoking.
Well, that's nothing that we haven't been saying for years, Tony.
Right. But the thing is, if in fact, we have these campaigns against obesity, we're going to raise taxes to try to keep people from drinking sugar-sweetened beverages. I hope we will raise taxes on cigarettes. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Maybe that'll happen in Kentucky this year. All these things we do, but what are we doing about loneliness? They have a minister for loneliness, someone who's starting to think about how communities could be knit together to try to protect older people protect all people from developing loneliness. And it's an interesting concept, and apparently this was something that was picked up worldwide. They talk about how many times that the article was cited announcing Tracy Crouch as the Minister for Loneliness. First of all, it's funny. But secondly, it could signal an additional way that we could help protect people and keep them from dying young.
How do you do that? How exactly? What's the first thing you do to try to first identify lonely people? And then put some kind of a campaign together to help them not be so lonely.
Right now my Band-Aid approach in rural Kentucky is to see if they're interested in church. Because that's a bunch of people that have gotten together for the specific purpose of spreading love. And so that's a great place to start. Ideally, we would recreate our neighborhoods so that people walk through the neighborhood.
You skipped question number one. How do you identify them?
How do you identify them?
I mean, is a lonely person going to self-identify?
There are questionnaires, but and there are hints. That's
or,
the other thing.
Or is this just something you build that they will come?
I mean, no. Well,
so if you bring the fair to town, will they come to the fair?
No. They clog our office. They fill up our office. They're statistically, scientifically more likely to see a doctor than people who aren't lonely. So absolutely, yeah, they
we
do
we call
that.
Those social visits.
Yeah. Yeah, there are times when we schedule a visit, and it's not like we're going to change a medicine or we're going to inject somebody's knee or do something like that. Instead, we're just going to sit and talk because we worry about them being lonely and being alone. So there is that. Rick, maybe we should go off the air and talk about this more.
Well, or we can make everybody else lonely. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is used with a proper diet and exercise program and possibly with other radio shows to control high blood sugar. Nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, weakness, or a metallic taste in the mouth may occur. If any of these effects persist or worsen, tell your doctor or pharmacist promptly.
Health Matters can rarely cause a serious, sometimes fatal condition called lactic acidosis. Stop listening to Health Matters and get medical help right away if you develop any of the following symptoms of lactic acidosis: unusual tiredness, dizziness, severe drowsiness, chills, cold skin, muscle pain, slow heartbeat, or stomach pain.
Read the patient information leaflet, if available from your pharmacist, before you start listening to our show and each time there is a break. If you have any questions, consult your doctor or pharmacist.
Tell your doctor immediately if any of these conditions occur or if you notice a big change in your overall health. You may need to stop listening to our show temporarily. The elderly are also at higher risk, especially those older than 80 years who have not had kidney tests.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Talk to each other. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.